Baikal 2 years ago looks and reflects on the devastation of the Earth. June 30, 1971. A blackened space capsule lies motionless in the Kazan desert. The Dawn barely dares to touch the charred edges of its heat shield. Meanwhile, a group of rescuers advances silently. They come prepared to greet three national heroes, Georgi Dobrovolsky, Vladislav Bolkov, and Viktor Pataev, the first human beings to live on a space station. The headlines in Moscow are already being written about a much-needed victory after losing the lunar race to the United States. However, upon reaching the capsule, someone from the rescue team decided to knock on the walls to let the crew know that they had arrived and that they were going to get them out of there immediately. But there was no response from inside, and when they finally managed to open the hatch, the scene was horrific. The three cosmonauts appeared with their seatbelts half unbuckled, their bodies covered in bruises and trickles of blood dripping from their ears and nostrils. No one understood a thing. The capsule had followed its normal trajectory and everything seemed to be going perfectly when they said goodbye to them. However, for strange reasons that we are going to tell you about now, the three cosmonauts of the Soyuz 11 had just become the first and, to date, only human beings to die in space. To understand what happened, we have to go back a few weeks. In early 1971, the Soviet Union was desperately looking for a triumph. The United States had won the moon race and propaganda needed another victory. The Soviet future no longer lay in going further, but in staying longer, dominating space by inhabiting it. The answer was the Soyuz 1, a space station built with the haste of someone who knew that failure was not an option. A metal cylinder barely 15 meters long and almost 100 cubic meters in volume, improvised with parts from previous programs, sewn together with the urgency of propaganda. A shiny coffin orbiting 200 kilometers above the Earth. It was a prototype and they knew it, but it had to work. On April 22nd of that same year, the Soyuz 10 took off with three cosmonauts on board. The Soyuz spacecraft managed to dock with that first space station, but it could not seal the tunnel connecting its capsule to the station, so the mission was a failure and they had to return to Earth empty-handed. The Soyuz 1 remained empty in space and the Kremlin knew that this would not last long and there was no time to waste. So the order was given to launch another mission as soon as possible. The crew assigned to finally dock is a luxury one. Alexei Leonov, the first human to perform a passive spaceflight a few years earlier, along with Valery Kubasov and Peter Kolodin, are the backups for Soyuz 10. Their launch is scheduled for June 6. However, just 3 days before, a medical setback will change history and their lives forever. A routine X-ray reveals a spot on Kubasov's lung. The doctors fear it may be tuberculosis and with no time to confirm, the medical committee decides to rule him out of the mission along with the rest of the crew. This was a hard blow for Lex Leonov, who was called to be the first man on the moon and who had previously lost that dream in favor of the American Neil Armstrong and who now saw how another chance to make history, being the first human to inhabit a space station, slipped away from him. But Soviet policy was very strict and the rules were clear. If a member of the crew had to be replaced, the entire team was replaced. What Alexei Leonov didn't know at the time was that he had just escaped death in space. So the three men we mentioned earlier burst onto the scene. Georgi Drobsky, 43, would be the commander. He would be accompanied by Vladislav Bolkov, 35, a flight engineer with experience on Soyuz 7, and Viktor Pataev, 37, an instrumentation specialist. In a few days, they went from being backups to being the main crew. They had hit the jackpot, or so they thought. June 6, 1971, Soyuz 11 lifted off from the Gagarin launch pad at Baikonur, propelled by the Soyuz rocket. The initial flight was flawless. The Soviet Union was about to make history by putting astronauts in low Earth orbit on a space station for the first time. 2 days later, they successfully docked with Soyuz 1, and this time they managed to properly seal the tunnel connecting their capsule to the station, so boarding was now possible. Patsayev became the first to cross the pressurized tunnel and thus became the first human to enter a space station. But problems soon began to arise. A strong smell of burning filled the interior of the station. Two electric fans overheated and the air began to thicken. That first night, the three cosmonauts slept inside the Soyuz as a precaution. The next morning, the smell had disappeared, but the warning remained. Soyuz 1 was not ready for long missions. Even so, the press showed images of the cosmonauts flying happily in Mikronovidod. However, in the images taken aboard Soyuz 1, we see that the cosmonauts are somewhat emaciated, with beards and tired faces. And it's really not surprising, because back then it wasn't entirely clear how to prepare the human body for a stay in space lasting several weeks, and to make matters worse, the problems were going to continue every day the cosmonauts were inside. The station clearly showed that it had been built in a hurry. It had constant noise, irregular lighting, condensation, variable temperatures, and a very stuffy atmosphere. Even so, the three cosmonauts weren't there on vacation. They were professionals and knew they had to work tirelessly because there was a lot to do. They made meteorological observations, took spectra of the Earth's horizon, measured gamma rays, and used an ultraviolet telescope, the Orion 1, for the first time. But after several days of hard work, the alarms went off again. A new smell of smoke was detected. Dobrovsky decided to turn off most of the equipment and switch to the secondary power supply. The incident didn't happen again, but all the scares, mistakes, and discomforts had already begun to take their toll on the crew, who were completely stressed out. On June 17th, during a routine communication session, Volkov showed signs of disagreement with Dobrovsky, his commander, over the way he expressed himself. As a result, he was told by mission control that he should obey his commander's orders. However, to Moscow's surprise, Volkov defiantly objected. He said, "We decide everything together as the crew that we are." The incident was left there, and after 23 days of broadcasting, the symptoms of fatigue were becoming increasingly evident. The cosmonauts were not sleeping well and could not exercise because the treadmills caused dangerous vibrations and movements in the fragile station. So much so that same day, seeing all the problems that were happening in orbit, Moscow decided to bring forward the crew's return, choosing June 29th as the day of their return. And that's when the first real warning came. On the day the astronauts returned to Earth, they had already been transferred to their Soyuz capsule, and all that remained was to close the hatch of their ship. However, when they got down to it, the pressure indicator didn't go out. Something didn't add up. "The hatch isn't airtight. What do we do? What do we do?" quote, Volkov shouted over the radio. Then, amidst all the commotion, came a very calm reply from Earth. "Don't worry, open the hatch again, move the control stick all the way to the left, close the hatch, and turn the stick 6.5 turns to the right." The words sounded precise, impersonal, as if dictated by a machine that didn't understand fear. Dobrovsky and Volkoven, but the red sensor kept glowing, stubborn as an unblinking eye. They repeated the procedure, once more, twice more, no way. The sign stayed on. The hatch couldn't seem to close. Inside the cockpit, the air became thick, suffocating. The three men looked at each other, knowing full well that a leaky hatch without suits was a death sentence. Because yes, indeed, the crew members were inside the capsule wearing normal clothes, as you can see in the images. It was a decision that had been known and assumed from the beginning. The Soyuz capsule was too small. If they wore bulky suits and spacesuits, only two of them would be able to travel. And the legendary engineer Sergei Korolev had made the decision considering that intravehicular suits were unnecessary, since the ship, in his opinion, was completely safe. And the truth is that it was. However, nothing is completely foolproof, and that day they were going to understand that. Meanwhile, in mission control, the engineers murmured among radios and papers. The technicians, calm, barely disguised their anguish. The pressure indicator was still on. The Soyuz hatch did not seem to seal properly. The engineers suspected that the fault was not real, that it was the sensor that was failing, but each minute felt like an eternity. Finally, a new instruction arrived: to place a piece of adhesive tape under the sensor contact. Dobrovsky obeys, presses the switch, and finally the light goes out. The crew breathes a sigh of relief. For half an hour they have struggled with a door that separates them from the void, and for a moment they think they have won. But without knowing it, they have just written the first line of the report of an accident that would be fatal. This improvised solution would be the first heartbeat of a tragedy that had already begun. On June 29th, after 23 days and 18 hours in orbit, they begin their return. Soyuz 11 undocks from the station and slowly moves away. Aboard it, the three cosmonauts observe the laboratory they are leaving behind. They have made history, and over the Atlantic Ocean in their 187th orbit, they were going to perform the engine ignition for the braking that would put them back on a trajectory towards Earth. All was going well. The three cosmonauts reported the successful braking ignition, and from Moscow they said goodbye to them, saying, "The communication is going to be cut off. Have a good trip." Quote. Later Volkov added, "See you tomorrow. Get the cognac ready." Quote. These were the last words heard from the crew. At an altitude of around 150 kilometers, as the spacecraft flies over France, Soyuz 11 begins the critical separation of its three modules: the orbital module, the service module, and the descent module. Each disconnection is triggered by pyrotechnic charges, and in a fraction of a second, 12 explosions release metal structures. The capsule vibrates, but this is a completely normal and routine procedure. However, this time the shock wave is going to unleash a tragedy. A valve barely 1 or 2 millimeters in diameter opens partially. It is a pressure equalization valve designed to balance the air inside and outside the capsule. A valve that had to open at an altitude of 3 kilometers to prevent the cosmonauts from suffocating if the hatch could not be opened after landing. A valve that obviously should not have been opened in the vacuum of space. The air begins to escape with a hiss. At first it is weak, barely a sigh, but Dobrovsky hears it. He knows that sound shouldn't exist. In a matter of seconds, the buzzing becomes a high-pitched, maddening screech. The pressure is dropping very quickly. The three cosmonauts unbuckle their seatbelts. Dorbobolsky, in the center seat, propels himself in weightlessness towards the front panel. There's no time to think. He quickly looks for the source of the noise, convinced that it's coming from the damned hatch, the same one that had given him trouble hours before. He checks the lock, the lever, the indicator. Everything seems fine, but the sound persists, getting louder and louder. He hasn't found the real problem, and he's just lost a few seconds that he simply didn't have. That damned hatch had just taken away all hope of life. The valve was right above them, hidden behind the control panels. Under normal conditions, it would have taken 35 to 40 seconds to close it manually, but they'd wasted those precious seconds checking the hatch, and after 50 seconds the internal pressure had dropped so fast that there was practically nothing left to do. The vacuum of space pulls at every molecule of air with the force of an invisible claw. A second after the modules separated, Brobolsky's pulse rose to 114 beats per minute and Volkov's to 180. A sure sign that they heard the whistle immediately and knew exactly what was happening. About 50 seconds after separation, Pachov's breathing reached a rate of 42 times per minute, an obvious symptom of oxygen deprivation. He was trying to take in more breaths to capture the little oxygen that remained, and at about the same time Brobolska's pulse dropped rapidly and he stopped breathing, probably due to unconsciousness. At 110 seconds after separation, no pulses were detected from the crew members. The pressure inside the capsule became practically zero. The doctors concluded that the three cosmonauts died between 90 seconds and 2 minutes after the modules separated. The capsule completed its descent without incident and landed in the Kazakhstan desert without incident. Rescue teams arrive in Mi-8 and Mi-6 helicopters. From the air, they see the capsule lying on its side. They knock on the fuselage, but there is no response. They open the hatch, and when they manage to look inside, the three men are sitting up, but they are not breathing. There are no signs of life, and trickles of blood are coming from their noses and ears. Their skin is covered in blood. Dobroy is unbuckled and the other two are only half buckled. Doctors begin CPR on the capsule itself, a minute and a half after landing. There is still hope. The resuscitation efforts last up to an hour, but there was nothing they could do. Autopsies will reveal widespread internal bleeding, cerebral thrombi, perforated eardrums, and lactic acid levels 10 times higher than normal. They died of hypoxia after 2 minutes of consciousness and 10 minutes of exposure to vacuum before the capsule descended into pressurized areas. The investigation into the accident is meticulous. The capsule was examined and the separation system was tested in vacuum chambers on Earth. However, they never managed to understand what happened on Earth. Simulating the conditions that occurred on Soyuz 11, the valve did not open. The most widely accepted hypothesis is that the shockwave from the explosive bolts caused a resonance that forced it open, but to this day there is still no definitive conclusion. In fact, to this day no other Soyuz has suffered a remotely similar accident. The crew was simply unlucky that day. Alex Leonov always felt guilty about the tragic outcome of the mission. He repeatedly stated that he would have been able to quickly identify the open valve and that he would have managed to close it without any problems, but we will never know. In addition, medical analysis confirms that with pressure-sensitive suits the cosmonauts would have survived perfectly. They would have needed just one more minute of oxygen to close the valve manually. The consequences of all this were immediate. Since then, no cosmonaut has flown without a pressure suit during launch or re-entry. Crews were reduced to 2 people until 1980, when a redesign of the Soyuz allowed 3 astronauts equipped with spacesuits to fit inside. As for the space station, Slyat 1 was never inhabited again. Its orbit decayed and it ended up disintegrating months later. The Soviet Union, already battered by the failures of the N1 rocket, suffered its greatest crisis. But a new era would emerge from the tragedy: mandatory safety. Redundant systems, engineering that did not compromise with politics. On June 1, 1971, the ashes of Brobolsky, Bolkov, and Potsayev were buried with honors next to the walls of the Kremlin. They were national heroes, but also victims of a chain of technical decisions driven by the urgency to demonstrate power. In the entire history of human exploration, only these 3 people have died in the vacuum of space. Not by fire, not by explosion, not even by impact, simply by a 2 mm hole. A valve that opened a few millimeters prematurely. Space does not forgive and never has. We are not made to live there, but we still try. Every mission is a fight against an environment that does not belong to us, and yet we claim it. We continue to push the horizon of what is possible, and let's not fool ourselves. We will continue to do so because that has always been part of who we are. We did it when we crossed mountains, oceans, when we flew, and now when we left our planet. And although space continues to remind us how fragile we are, each step outside is a way of measuring our limits and accepting that we will never stop searching for them.